Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Welcome to the Naturalist program on Heritage Radio Network. This is Carol Butler. I am Bernie Wide's new official co-host for
the
program.
So welcome to your new status, Carol.
Thank you.
We're equal partners.
I'm trying to get used to it.
Right.
But this is very nice. And we have a special guest today. We have Peter Capagnolo with us, who is an ornithologist from the Museum of Natural History, and who is my co-author on the new raptor book called How Fast Can a Falcon Dive? So welcome, Peter.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We found a parking spot.
Yes.
And we're all set here in Roberta's wonderful studio. I just want to mention before we start asking Peter questions, I had a wonderful phone conversation this morning with Loretta Jones, who is the head of the Hawk Creek Wildlife Center in Aurora, New York. They did a demonstration in Central Park this Saturday, and mm-hmm. I went to meet her because we'd interviewed her last year, mm-hmm. and we have a photograph of Canyon, their eagle that was hit by an airplane.
Mm.
Wonderful story. And she received the book, and she's all excited about it.
Great.
So, but I did see all the Hawk Creek people, and I saw Canyon again on Saturday,
good.
So that was really nice.
So, Carol, what's the next book coming out after this raptor book?
Well, I have a book on horses coming out,
okay.
But it's in a different publisher, a different
format.
It started out as question and answer, but it's a little different. It's done with an artist rather than all the photographs and drawings that we have in this one. So she illustrated the whole book.
Okay, that's good.
So we'll get to that.
Yes, okay, that's in the works.
In the works. So let's talk with Peter,
sure.
since we have him here. Peter, I thought we would start. Tell us what you do at the museum, what you can talk about.
Uh-huh. I'm a senior scientific assistant in the Department of Ornithology, and under the supervision of the collections manager and the curators, I'm involved in maintaining the collections, adding to the collections. I do a little bit of research with the collections. I assist researchers when they come in from all over the world, mm-hmm. working on different kinds of birds, finding specimens, basically collections care.
Okay, so mm-hmm. when you say the collections, do you mean bird skins?
Yes, bird skins, skeletons, yeah. tissues now for DNA work.
So that's a new addition to your responsibility, to the DNA stuff now.
Yeah, I'd say within the last 15, 20 years, that's become a very large part of what we do.
So do you do the DNA in the museum, in your lab, or you send it to the lab upstairs or wherever it is?
The bird department, the ornithology department, has a state-of-the-art lab on the sixth floor, lab with a full staff of molecular biologists.
Yes, I know that one, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Very good.
So you do the whole thing?
Yeah, pretty much, whatever needs to be done. We don't have a lot of folks working in collections, so whatever needs to be done, we try to do.
Now, I remember going to your lab downstairs one day, and you got this huge bird.
Yeah, it's a different lab.
Right, that's a different lab. But tell about that lab, because that lab is really interesting.
Well, that's the, it's called the Anatomical and Preparation Lab. So while we have a nice state-of-the-art molecular lab on the sixth floor, we've got a very ancient,
very primitive
1800s lab on the lower level. Uh-huh. It's the only floor of the department that hasn't been renovated, so really kind of neat, because it's kind of harkens back to the old days of Linnaeus and people like this.
Right. Well, he never worked at the museum.
No, he didn't.
A lot of other famous people did.
Yeah. Yes, they do. Do you have those beetles, the Dermestid
beetles?
Yes.
They're actually in a different building. They're in a different section, a hermetically sealed room.
All right.
Because we use those beetles to eat the flesh off of the bones so we can get skeletal material from the bird specimens.
Right.
But they have a fondness for all organic matter, so they could come in and damage.
Eat the feathers and everything.
Oh, yeah, eat everything.
So why they have to keep it separate.
Yeah, we love them, we hate them, it's that kind of thing. But but Carol was referring to the time she went down to the lab and to look around, and had some kind of a heron or some huge creature on the table, eviscerated.
Right, but you get these creatures from, that was from a zoo, I think, or?
Yeah, zoological parks, rehabilitators, these days collecting specimens, going out and procuring them requires a lot of permits, requires a lot of preparation and so on, and we're much more limited, of course.
Collecting means actually killing them.
Yeah, going out and hunting them.
Hunting
them and preparing them in the field. That still goes on to a limited extent.
Mm-hmm.
But we get an awful lot of material from rehabilitators and zoos, that birds and other animals, for the other departments, succumb to their injuries.
Right.
Yeah,
I was up at New York City Audubon the other day, and they asked me to ask around if any birds got killed flying into the planetarium, because they're doing a project about birds getting killed flying into buildings in the
especially
city.
Especially glass buildings.
Right.
Yeah.
And Peter said people are always bringing up birds that have crashed into the buildings of the museum. And I was at a book signing out in New Jersey, and there was a woman from a rehab in Teaneck, and she didn't contact me.
No, I don't think so.
Someone had brought them a case of birds that were all taxidermied, preserved specimens, and a couple of them were very rare or extinct birds. And she said, I've been wanting to get them to the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, give me a call, I'll give you Peter's contact information. So this is what happens, sort of specimens come to you from all different areas, and you have to figure out what to do with them.
Yeah, the fresh material, of course, it comes from rehabbers, as I said, or zoos, but occasionally someone will find an old collection of prepared skins, specimens that perhaps one of their relatives 50, 100 years ago, they still find these things in the attic, and the
garage.
That's
exactly what this was. Yeah, they
and
found it.
Yeah, and sometimes, if it's got really good data on it, it's valuable material.
Mm. Yeah, I remember reading the history of the museum in that book, The Dinosaurs in the Attic or something, about Teddy Roosevelt, when he was a young kid. They were just starting the museum, and he donated his collection of skins, I think, to help start off the museum.
Yes,
that's when it was still in the armory in Central Park, right?
Yeah, we have some.
Still have those old skins,
right? Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But a lot of people do. I'm trying to think of the name. There's wonderful artist who illustrated the butterfly book. It's terrible, I can't think of his name. But he was from Kansas, and he had an extensive collection of butterflies from Kansas, and he donated that whole collection to the museum. So somewhere in all of those closets, there's a collection of every butterfly in Kansas that he donated.
Right.
So a lot of people do that. It's interesting.
Yeah, well, it's valuable material. If it has data, it's particularly valuable.
Right.
If you have a bird specimen, a skin from 1890 from the Adirondacks, or a butterfly from Kansas, if there's no date or location on it, there's not much we can do with that. I mean, they're gorgeous. Maybe perhaps an artist could use them as a model or something, but biologically, there's not much you can do with that. Yeah.
Mm.
So how did you get interested in birds? How did you end up here?
Well, it's not genetic. My brother and sister, my parents, well, didn't seem to have much interest in that sort of thing at all.
But they were supportive of you.
They were. Yeah. I have to say thanks to them. Supportive by leaving me alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's good support.
Yeah, there wasn't any discouragement. There wasn't necessarily all kinds of encouragement either. I can't remember not being interested in natural history and from the time I was a little kid. Just always out in the woods or just out in the yard. I was born in New York City, but I grew up in Suffolk County, Patchogue on the South Shore.
Oh, yeah,
we moved there in the 1960s.
It was still country then.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah. We moved to the country. And my brother and sister, they're older than I am. So, they remember the city more. We lived in the Bronx. But I remember the woods and the creeks and the salt marshes and the beaches, and just grew up, playing around in the woods, bringing stuff home, bringing snakes home, bringing toads home, dead or alive. I might find it dead or find it alive.
Mm-hmm.
If it happened to be dead, it would go in the freezer.
Right.
Your mother loved that.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, like I said, no discouragement, no encouragement.
Right.
It's just kind of bitter lip, I suppose.
Well, but as a mother, I would say that's encouragement.
Yeah.
To put dead things in your freezer.
Yeah. But she got me taxidermy lessons when I was about 12 years old.
Wow. Okay.
So that I could do something with these things. So I was always interested in this. I kept pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a hawk, it was probably a Cooper's hawk, came out of the woods, killed one of the pigeons, and ate it on the lawn, and that's when I became fascinated with the raptors.
Yeah.
So, and then we have a story in the book about how I bought a hawk from the back of a magazine when I was about 13 years old.
Really?
Oh. Well, we're going to have to take a break in a moment, but I want you to tell that story when we start the next section.
Great.
Right.
Let's take a break and we'll begin with the story of Peter's hawk. We're back with The Naturalist, with Bernie Wides, and Peter Capagnolo is visiting with us today. And Peter was just about to tell the story of how he got his first hawk. So why don't you begin with that?
Yeah, well, being interested in the birds of prey, obviously I wanted to find out everything I could about them. So I go down to the Patchogue Library, it was a small library at the time, and they had two books about falconry. The art and practice of taking wild raptors and using them for hunting. And they were both books from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what a fortnight was at the time.
Right.
Do this with the hawk for a fortnight. It's like, what is that?
Right.
So then I had to look that up. All kinds of other things. And a lot of the birds that occur in Europe, you don't find... I'm sorry, the birds that you find here in North America, you don't find over there. So there was this sort of problem with interpretation, even though it was the English language.
Yeah, a lot of the names of the birds are different, too.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. They don't have red-tailed hawks over there, so I was reading about red tails here, and there was nothing in their books about them. Well, anyway, I had a paper route, and I used to read Field and Stream magazine because we hunted, we fished, out there, and in the back of Field and Stream in those days, you could buy animals. And the practice is completely, you can't do that anymore. And there was a place in Florida that advertised birds of prey for falconry.
Well, you can't do that here, but you can do it in other countries.
Well, right, still. Right, right. Yeah. There was this little sort of magazine that they sent me that showed you what they had and how much they were and this and that. I'm like, oh, I gotta get a hawk. I want
to buy a hawk. It's amazing to even just imagine.
Oh, that, it's incredible.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, today. It's just, and it's not that long ago, but there was this photo of a red-tailed hawk on this fellow's fist, and it was, I don't remember, $40. Mm-hmm. And so I worked my paper out. I saved up my money, these kinds of things. I sent cash in the mail, $40, to this place, said I'd like to have a red-tailed hawk. They had an order form.
Right.
So, I don't know, a week or so later, and no thought of permits, nothing like that. I didn't know what I needed, if I just had no idea. Get a phone call from Islip MacArthur Airport out there on Long Island. And my brother and his friend went off and they got this huge box. And there's a hawk in it. Hmm. And it must have been 3 feet high, the box.
Right.
Yeah, really large. And the packing slip said, well, we're sorry, we don't have any more red-tailed hawks. We've sent you a red-shouldered hawk.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, a hawk's a hawk. I'm interested in these things. So we according to my British books, you know, you're supposed to open the box in the dark and, you know, not disturb the, trying to follow everything to the letter. So we're in the basement with a little flashlight and we open this box, and way down in the corner is this tiny little, you know, bantam-sized bird. You know, mm-hmm.
You're expecting, you know,
expecting
huge,
the right, expecting right. The head to be at the top,
yeah,
of the box,
right.
You know. So we took him out of there, and this medium-sized brown bird with red patches on its shoulder, mm-hmm. and a white rump patch, and beautiful bird. So we took him out of there, and we put Jess's on him, these soft leather straps around the legs, and put him on his little perch, and he calmed down. And I was looking at him, and the only bird book I had was Audubon's Birds of America, a copy of that with all of Audubon's paintings. So right away I go look, and I'm looking at the red-shouldered hawk. I said, well, this bird doesn't look like a red-shouldered hawk. I mean, certainly not a red-tailed hawk, like they said. And for a while I was stumped. I didn't know what this bird was. And I finally stumbled upon Audubon's painting of Harris's hawk, which is a bird of the Southwest. I think Audubon collected the first specimen east of the Mississippi, but it's a western bird. And this was a full adult Harris's hawk. And so I had him for a couple of years and got him coming back to the fist, flying to the fist, and chasing squirrels and these sorts of things. So that was the first experience with a live raptor.
Now, I remember you telling me that training a hawk to follow your, to cooperate, mm-hmm. with you, is called manning,
right?
And I have this image of Peter sitting in the living room with the hawk on his wrist, watching TV.
Well, that's right. That's an exact image.
Right,
that's
right.
That's right. Well, manning is when you're just getting it used to people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It sits on the glove, and you pretty much take it everywhere, and it gradually calms down. It's amazing how these sort of fierce wild birds do tame down. They accept a person as a companion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the training part is separate from the manning part. That's where you start getting the bird to come back to your fist for a tidbit of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually you increase that distance,
right.
and use a whistle or some kind of signal. It's all Pavlovian response kind of thing, positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point the bird can be, you know, way up in a tree or up in the air, and you can call it down, and they know to come down. They also start to realize very quickly that you're going to flush game for them.
Mm.
You walk along, rabbit runs out, or a pheasant flushes. I mean, this is what they do in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
You're just helping along, and you know, it's sort of like, you know, falconry is to hunting like fly fishing is to fishing. You know, it's just this real natural kind of process where you're not really you're sort of a spectator.
Mm-hmm.
Watching what's going on. You facilitate a little bit, but that's about
right.
it.
I want to read the quote from Stephen Bodio,
yeah.
which is what I was trying to look for. He says, when you hunt with a falcon, your purpose in the field is to assist the bird, Your reward is the companionship of a creature that could disappear over the horizon in 15 seconds flat, right? And Tom Cade says, to have such a magnificent creature as a hawk, falcon, or eagle accept you as its companion and to allow you to enter its space is to gain a rare perspective on life. Yeah.
So did you had enough woods left around Patchwork that you could take the bird out on your wrist?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you did it?
Yep.
And then if something flushed up, he would take off and go after it?
Or it depends on the kind of bird it is. Falcons, true falcons, usually they strike other birds out of the air in a stoop. They dive. It's called a stoop in falconry. And they try to knock a bird out of the air.
Right.
But hawks, like Harris's hawks, chase mammals more often than birds. And so what you do is you get Harris's hawks or red-tailed hawks, these kinds of birds, to follow along branch to branch. So you don't have to carry them on the fist.
Okay.
Put them up in the tree, let them just follow. They're completely
free.
They
follow you along.
They follow you along. Sometimes you have a dog. More often you have a bunch of friends.
Right.
And you just kind of beat the bushes and see what kind of game animals you can flush.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, that bird has an advantage being up in the tree and then goes after the quarry, just like it would in nature on its own.
Mm.
It's interesting because some raptors, like kestrels, these little falcons that hover, you're probably familiar with those, they're quite common, they follow tractors, they follow people plowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes see a dozen kestrels following a tractor in a field because
all
the bugs and mice,
right.
Running around, and they don't care that person's there. It's just,
right.
It's a way to get food.
Well, I was with the New York City Audubon Group on top of Hook Mountain in the Palisades trying to see the raptor migration last weekend, and there weren't too many raptors migrating. It was disappointing, but there were a lot of vultures, black vultures. And we were busy looking at the vultures. When you're talking about the way the animals hunt, we're busy saying, oh, because they're beautiful,
yeah,
and
sure.
I'm trying to take photographs of them. And then I realized at a certain point, they were watching us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They were circling. You know, they were not migrating.
No,
here were these 20 crazy
right.
people standing on top of this mountain for hours.
Fresh meat.
Yeah. And they were coming really close and swooping, and not in a threatening way, but they were keeping their distance. But they were definitely, you could tell that was their style. They were just looking around.
And they probably saw you 50 miles away, too.
Oh, yeah.
They saw you a long time before that.
No, they go way off, you're right, and then come back in.
Right. Maybe you guys could settle this dispute about how they hunt. I learned when I was working in the Park Service that they hunt by smell.
You mean the vultures?
The vultures.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The black vultures and the turkey vultures.
Yes,
they could be way up. And that
this is a painful topic. But go ahead.
I don't know if we can resolve this.
No, we cannot resolve this.
They basically hunt carrion, right? Dead
right.
stuff.
Yeah, they're finding carrion.
So we learned that they do it by smell. Mm-hmm. That they have very sensitive noses, and the smell is just waft up, and then they can find it that way. And then some say, no, they don't do it by smell.
Well, we discussed this in the book.
Yeah,
this was a big topic. Every source that I looked at says that they have, turkey vultures particularly, have a very sensitive sense of smell. And there were a couple of studies where, I think two studies that I've read about, which we've mentioned, where people hide dead chickens, right, and watch to see whether they're not visually accessible, and the turkey vultures find them, not when the meat is fresh, but at a certain point after a couple of days, and if they're too rotten, they don't find them. Okay. There's another study that's similar, and so I was sort of convinced that they have a very sensitive sense of smell. However, Peter has a friend named Bill Robinson who has turkey vultures, and Bill Robinson says no. I met Bill earlier in the summer, so we put it in the book. You can. Bill says he's done this. He's hidden dead birds, and the turkey vultures never find them.
Yeah.
And you know, who knows? I mean, these two studies don't prove anything.
That's true. Yeah.
And people copy from one book to another. Yeah. I know it because I wrote about female orgasm, and I can tell you that every book I saw said things that traced back to some other book that were incorrect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But everybody said the same thing based on what some man wrote in 1944, mm-hmm. based on nothing.
Right.
So unless we have our own turkey vultures, Bernie.
Well, we have Peter here.
Yeah, Well, Bill's had these turkey vultures for a long time.
We have
time.
Room on the roof.
Yeah, you could, yeah.
That's, right, Roberta's should get some turkey vultures.
And some carcasses.
And then we'll have, yeah, carcasses, we'll have a definitive answer.
And you know, Jack's here all the time. He could take care of them, right,
that's
Jack?
Right. That's right.
We can
you
add
could
that.
Feed the vultures.
Add that to his many tasks, yeah, right.
They have some vile habits, but they're nice birds.
Well, I wonder if they like pizza crust.
Probably.
They eat a lot of things, right?
They do. They do. There's an account in our book about,
go ahead.
About a group of black vultures in Mexico following a stray dog down the street early in the morning. And you think, well, they're waiting for the dog to die. Well, they were waiting for the dog to relieve itself, defecate. So as soon as it did, they all came in and ate it.
a lot of animals do that.
Yeah, sure.
Vultures. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of nourishment left over, especially elephants. In Africa, after the elephants poop, there's a whole gang that come
mm-hmm.
over and
sure.
eat yeah. the leftovers, besides yeah. the scarab bug, which is a
yeah.
famous, he rolls it into balls.
The dung beetles,
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting off the track here, but I think we're almost at the end of the
segment.
We got
a one-minute signal, but then I don't know where the music is not playing, so there we go.
Okay.
But we'll take a break and we'll be back shortly. Okay, we are back with Peter Campagnolo, my co-author on How Fast Can a Falcon Dive? And I wanted to ask Peter about this. When I was at Central Park on Saturday, when the Hawk Creek rehab people were there with a whole bunch of birds, they talk about them, and they were flying them. Probably a lot of listeners have seen this kind of demonstration. Mm-hmm. Where, just as you described, they hold the bird on a glove and somebody else gets a certain distance away and has a little piece of food, and the bird most of the time cooperates and flies. Sometimes they don't. And what they were saying in the park when I got there, they were already in progress. There had been a hawk. Because we have pale male is right adjacent to the park, and there are a lot of red-tailed hawks around. There evidently was a red-tailed hawk that had chased one of the
trained ones.
Trained birds. and they were in the I was sitting looking up at the sky and looking in the trees to see where the wild birds
see,
were.
Anything can happen with these things.
So they were very concerned because the wild hawks were protecting their territory. Yeah. But what the woman said who was narrating the demonstration was about, I don't know if it was, it must have been one particular species, and I don't know which one it was, but she said it has the intelligence of a 7-year-old child. Which really struck me. I hadn't heard that.
I've never heard anything like that. Measuring intelligence in other animals is difficult anyway.
Right.
And we do know that birds like crows and parrots, which tend to be sort of communal, have a social order and vocalization. So they're probably more intelligent than, say, a sparrow or, relatively speaking. Birds of prey, all predatory animals, are probably intelligent, because of the way that they have to survive. Mm. Use all kinds of strategies. Mm-hmm. And Harris's hawks, we were talking about before, mm-hmm. do hunt cooperatively.
Right. That's very unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual in the raptors.
For raptors. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that the only example, really? Are there some others that do it, too? I don't remember hearing about that.
Well, yeah. it's the only species of raptor that I'm aware of actively does that. I mean, you can tell that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Three or four of them, one will chase a jackrabbit, let's say, which is a large quarry. When that bird gets tired, another one
takes over.
And then when the animal's finally captured, they all kind of come in and share.
Mm.
You may see groups of raptors hunting, like those kestrels I talked mm-hmm. about, following a tractor.
Yeah.
But that's not really cooperative among the birds.
Right.
So a bird with the intelligence of a 7-year-old human being seems like a stretch. Yeah,
it seems like a stretch to me.
We didn't come
across anything like mm-hmm. that in the research. What I came across recently was something about birds' brains, and they were saying that birds that fly have smaller brains than birds that function on the ground, mm. obviously because they need to be light and they need to be as light as possible. Mm. And so that sort of makes you wonder about their intelligence if their brains are smaller, but it's the parts of the brains, I guess.
Well, most bird brains are eye. I mean, it's exactly right.
Most birds' heads are eye,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. The orbits take up a huge amount of space.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you think of an owl, their head is practically nothing but eye. Mm-hmm. Their eyes are so huge.
So important.
And with raptors, too, their vision. We talk about the vision in the book about how they can see, you know, they can read a newspaper if they were inclined to do that.
They'd have to be older than 7.
Right.
Depends which newspaper.
Yes, right, yes, right. It's true, and the, right. their intelligence level right. to read now.
Right. Well,
But they can read a simple newspaper.
There you go.
The length of a football field. You know, there's all these kinds of comparisons in the literature based on somebody's fantasy. Yeah. But the idea is they see really well. Yeah. And they do interesting research. Some of it is online in video, where they put an eagle in front of television screens and they manipulate the images, and the eagle is very sharp about, you know, identifying whatever they're supposed to identify.
You think it's a sports section they were reading on the football field? You know, let's just get back, Peter.
Yeah.
We never followed your route from when you got the first bird. How did you end up at the museum?
It's a long journey. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I was always interested in natural history. You know, the raptors were just part of it. In high school, I wasn't even sure if I was going to go to college or just find a job. And you may have heard of Professor Heinz Meng up at the State University of New Paltz.
Right.
And I decided, well, if I'm going to do anything with birds, I have to go to college. And I only applied to one. SUNY New Paltz, and I went and I studied under Heinz zoology and practiced falconry with him. And there were other students there who had gravitated to New Paltz because of him. And as you know, he was one of the first scientists to breed peregrines in captivity. That's in our book as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And we mentioned some of the other folks who did.
We'll talk about captive breeding in the next program because that's an interesting topic.
Yeah, well, Heinz did do a lot of that. And After that, I worked for some nature centers and for some schools. I actually was at the American Museum of Natural History in the 1980s. Mm. 84, they used to have an animal behavior department. They were working on song of zebra finches.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked there for a while, working on those birds. And then
was that a full-time job?
That was a full-time job, yeah. And I was, 25 or mm-hmm. something like that. And then left and actually developed some small museums out on Long Island at some nature centers.
Mm-hmm.
And then started teaching on the college level. I was at several community colleges as an adjunct. And then about 10 years ago, came back to the museum, to the ornithology department, in my current capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also an adjunct faculty member at CUNY City College, teaching ornithology and human biology.
Yeah. And you teach one course at the museum.
Yeah, I teach with Jeff Groth, who's at the museum, who helped with the book, who's a great friend and colleague, smart guy.
Right.
We co-teach an ornithology class at the museum through CUNY. And the students come to us. Everything's there, you know.
Right. Yeah. Which, if you're interested in studying about birds, that would be a great place to start.
Yes,
because they're always bringing all kinds of specimens into the class. They have everything at their fingertips.
Everything's there. Yeah.
And the classroom is right in the museum, so it's really very special.
Yeah. Were you still living out in Patchogue in those days?
In those days.
After college, or
I lived in Patchogue for a while, and I lived in Huntington.
Pernie lived out there.
The reason I'm asking, because they have that facility in Quogue, the Rehabilitation Center.
Used to go there all the time as a kid,
Were you connected with them at all?
Only as a visitor. I'd go and look around, and before I could drive, I'd, coerce people into taking me. And walk the whole grounds. And I used to spend a lot of time out there. It's a great place.
Yeah, for people who don't know what we're talking about, out in Suffolk County on the South Shore, is the town of Quogue, right near the Hamptons and Hampton Bays, I think is the next town. And they have this rehabilitation center for animals that have been injured or somehow injured, right? And they can't live in the wild.
Yeah.
So they're rehabilitated there. And they probably spend their whole lives there.
Yeah, permanently disabled, non-releasable birds are there. But they also have this beautiful nature center and observatory over the old ice pond.
Right, right.
And
it's a lovely spot.
Yeah, I've lectured there a couple of times. And looking out over that pond is just, if you're interested in waterfowl, ducks, these sorts of birds, that's a great place.
Yeah, if you have any kids, they do great programs on the weekend. And in the summer, I think they have a day camp, too.
Maybe. I haven't been
in a
while.
Yeah, I was out there this summer. Stopped out to see it. So I didn't want to take you off the track, I know if you live on Long Island.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and if you were interested in wildlife, then you heard about Quogue and that.
Yeah. And did you know that family that lived on the Carmen's River? They had a big piece of property. The guy was a famous naturalist.
Painter.
Yeah, the painter.
It's a long time ago. I know who you mean.
Just
trying to remember the name.
I can't remember the name either, but I remember that we knew about that place, and we canoe down the river and occasionally stopped there. Because a friend of mine knew his daughter, so we stopped in to say hello.
Yeah.
They were a terrific family. Yeah. The Wertheim Preserve.
Right. Is that it? Yeah, it's a federal reserve. Right. Yeah, right nearby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great spot.
And he was a great painter and naturalist. And
But I can't remember his name.
I can't remember his name. It's awful. Back. Yeah.
Right. Maybe it'll come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I don't. We'll talk more. I'm interested in talking about falconry, I posted some illustrations from the book on the website for the show, this show, and the next one that we're doing. Okay, I pulled out all the images that we had of lure flying and the Madonna-ing and all different things that are involved. We have a drawing that I posted that is not in the book because Peter made a drawing because I couldn't imagine how you catch a falcon, how you catch one of these wild birds. And he was explaining it to me, and I said, I can't visualize it. We have to get an illustration for the book. And so Peter drew it. We're at the end of the section, but we'll talk about it in the next program when we talk about falconry and hunting, and we'll start with how you catch the falcon or how you catch a wild bird.
Yeah. So we're going to sign off now, and the next program will be on next week. This week will be this one that we just did now, and Peter's going to be back again for the second show. And we'll start off with falconry. Is that what we're going to do?
Yeah, let's talk about falconry.
Yeah, so the second show will be on falconry and anything else on raptors. If anybody wants to make some comments, put it on our website or call in to the network, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for having me.